Lecture 5. Caste, Varna, and Jati.
Caste is probably the most distinctive feature of Indian society. Outsiders have understood it in their own ways, and the inequalities it represents have been debated by Indian traditionalists and reformers in the past and even today. So the various beliefs and practices now associated with the term caste have long and complex histories. We should consider some of the earliest models from ancient Indian society that may reveal some of the origins of what 20 centuries later was called the caste system by Europeans. The word caste or casta is Portuguese. When Vasco da Gama discovered how to sail from Europe around southern Africa and reached India in 1498, he tried to understand Indian society in his own terms. For years, the Portuguese believed that all Indians were Christians, since Christians, Jews, and Muslims were the only major religions that they knew about at that time. Only gradually did the Portuguese realize that most Indians followed a different religious tradition, which these Europeans eventually called Hinduism. Likewise, Vasco da Gama and his Portuguese successors tried to describe the many hierarchically ranked social groups they encountered when they entered India's ports. The Portuguese term casta means breed, as in a breed of horses or a breed of cattle. While this term stuck as caste and is still widely in use today, it does not accurately describe either Indian social models or actual social practice. In order to see the emic origins of this model, that is, the earliest Indian explanations of its origins, we should turn to a close reading of one of the sacred Vedic hymns that explains the creation of the four orders of human beings as part of the origin of the cosmos. This hymn seems to reflect the social processes that have been going on at that time, so let's recall them here. Remember that we've seen how various clans associated with ancient bodies of knowledge, known as the Veda, gradually migrated into India from the northwest. Scholars date that immigration from roughly 1500 to 500 BCE. When these many clans arrived, they interacted with the cultures and communities already there, particularly the forest-based Adivasi and the more agriculturally oriented descendants of the dispersed Indus civilization. In each of the Indian subcontinent's regions, distinctive communities and cultures developed. Each ecological niche had different environmental conditions, so the types of agriculture, housing, and economy generally differed in each, although there were broad patterns across the subcontinent as well. The Veda is an ancient form of the Sanskrit language, but in each region of North India, one of a dozen different vernacular languages gradually evolved, derived from Sanskrit. Many of the words were the same, although their meanings and pronunciation might shift somewhat. For example, Sanskrit has an inherent short A at the end of many words, but most popular Sanskrit-derived languages do not. So the name of the increasingly popular god Ram would be pronounced in Sanskrit as Rama. But the four distinct languages in South India were from a different language family, Dravidian. It appears that these cultures probably originated from the Indus civilization, which we discussed earlier. After the Indus cities and economy declined around 1700 BCE, its people evidently migrated into North, Central, and South India. While the Vedic people came to dominate in the North and parts of Central India culturally, in South India, the Dravidian culture remained strong. While some Adivasi people mixed with the settled agriculturalists around them, other Adivasi continued to live mainly in forests, largely practicing Swidden or shifting agriculture and holding on to their own languages and ways of life. So many people across India probably have a genetic heritage from Adivasis, although they do not actually recognize that, and culturally they've become quite different, and they speak a Vedic Sanskrit-derived or Dravidian language. As analyzed by Edic scholars, including linguists and historians, the earliest of the Vedas revealed clans who were herders with little internal social differentiation. Some individuals and families seem to have specialized in preserving and reciting the cosmic knowledge contained in the Vedic hymns and in performing the rituals that gained the favor and gifts from the gods. Over time, these Vedic ritual specialists claim more power for themselves. By performing ritual sacrifices, these priests fed deceased ancestors and also the gods. As the recipients of food, the divinities were obliged to reciprocate by giving what these priests called for, that is, prosperity, sons, and victories, including victory over death. All this meant that the concept of the sacrifice stood central to the creation of the universe, including the creation of human beings. Since these priests possessed the Vedas and performed the sacrifice, when we look at Vedic poems, we're usually seeing things from the priest's perspective. Other Vedic families evidently specialized in martial skills. They led Vedic clans into battle, either to defend themselves and their livestock, or else to defeat their rivals. At first, they fought other Vedic clans. But as they immigrated and settled in India, they also fought the Adivasi and Indus communities that they encountered. Most Vedic people, however, remained pastoralists, artisans, and then also farmers. They produced the food, implements, and other material things needed by the entire community. Now let's examine the one late Rig Vedic hymn, the oft-cited Book 10, Hymn 90, that puts these processes in sacred terms. This hymn proclaims how the gods themselves served as priests in the primal sacrifice that created the entire universe. This text describes cosmic man as virtual infinity, having, quote, 1,000 heads, 1,000 eyes, and 1,000 feet. Having covered the earth on all sides, he extended 10 fingers' breadth beyond it. So much is his greatness, but man is more than this. This cosmic man transcended time, what has come into being and what is yet to be. All the gods performed the sacrifice of this cosmic man. Everything in the universe emerged. The Vedic, the seasons, all animals, and humankind as well. This hymn then goes on to describe how the respective parts of the cosmic man, his mouth, arms, thighs, and feet, each became an order of beings. Created from his mouth were Brahmins, the ritual specialists who spoke the Veda and ritually consumed the food that fed the gods and ancestors. From the arms of the cosmic man came the rulers, the Rajya, or later Kshatriya. We can see how kings and warriors would be associated with strong arms. From the thighs of the cosmic man came the rest of Vedic peoples, the Vaishya. They were able to reproduce both children and also material resources like food and clothing. So far, these three highest orders of humans seem to reflect the social patterns found in other Indo-European daughter cultures. As the French historian of religion, Georges Dumézil, noted, most Indo-European cultures have divinities and orders of people who perform one of the three core functions: spiritual, leadership, war, leadership, and productivity. In medieval and early modern Europe, for example, society was thought of as composed of three estates: the clergy as the first estate, barons and nobility as the second estate, and the general populace as the third estate. Later, from the 18th century onward, the news media have come to be known as the fourth estate. As in Vedic society, in other Indo-European cultures, the first two functions, spiritual and martial leadership, that is, church and state, are often rivals for supremacy. To complete the sacrifice of the cosmic man, a fourth order of human beings came from his feet, those who were to serve the other orders, later known as the Shudra. Since this fourth order was not part of the Indo-European model, it apparently represents people already in India when the Vedic clans arrived. In this hymn, these servants are recognized as part of society, but at the lowest level. Members of all four orders thus came from the same cosmic origin. This one late Vedic hymn thus evidently shows how an emerging social order, the Brahmins, perceived the origins of humans in a way that legitimized their own status at the highest level. Since all people classed as human came from the same cosmic man, all are parts of the same entity. Nevertheless, the hymn shows a ranking of the four social orders, later known as Varna, literally meaning ritual color. Brahmins were associated with white, Kshatriyas with red, Vaishyas with green, and Shudra with blue or blue-black. But it would be a mistake to identify those four ritual colors with skin complexion, since the Edic concept of race does not fit very well with the Emic concept of the system of Varna. Also, nowhere in the Rig Veda is there any assertion that these orders were hereditary or unchangeable within a person's lifetime, features that only later became associated by outsiders with the caste system. But later, post-Vedic texts did elaborate on this one Rigvedic hymn of the sacrifice of cosmic man, making each Varna appear more defined and separate. As we'll see in later lectures, as these characteristics developed over time, Brahmins, Kshatriyas, and Vaishya would go through a special ritual that was a spiritual rebirth, making them twice born. Yet these top three Varnas would continue to be only about 20% of the population. In contrast, people classed as Shudra composed more than half the population. Now, the remaining quarter of the population did not have a Varna. Hence, they were often throughout history called the fifth order, or outcasts, or untouchables. This non-Varna group also included most Adivasis. Eventually, each region in India had a particular mix of these Varnas. In some regions, especially in the North Indian Gangetic Plain, a much larger proportion of the population were identified as Brahmins or Kshatriyas. Even there, however, they were still a relatively small percentage of the total society. In South Indian regions, the proportion of people ranked as Brahmins or Kshatriya were much less, with the vast majority of the population ranked as Shudra. So Edic scholars correlate this with a settlement pattern of Indo-European clans in the north, but less in the south. But it's a long way from this one Rigvedic hymn about Varna to what the Portuguese and later many other outsiders and insiders in India called caste. Another set of social processes produced a different emic category, jati, meaning birth. The Portuguese merged that into their own term caste. So let's look at the ways that jatis may have come about. Evidently, during the same late Vedic period that Brahmins were conceptualizing Varnas as the four broad orders of humans, social and cultural forces were also creating more localized social groups known as jati. This term is not actually in the Veda, so it was not yet recognized by Brahmins. But there are suggestions in the later Veda that this social practice was beginning to coalesce. The core concept of a jati was that people were born into this social group with an inherited specific dharma, meaning code for conduct. Broadly, this birth group could be any social category. For example, women and men are spoken of as separate jatis. But the most widespread use of this term jati referred to people of the same traditional occupation, like weavers, goldsmiths, herders, warriors, or professional priests. Compared to the system of Varna, where the groups were huge in number, the system of jatis was much more relevant to everyday life. Not all members of a jati, however, actually earned their living from that traditional occupation. Further, some occupations, like farming, were followed by various jatis. Each region had a particular mix of jatis, but we can't completely explain why these jatis developed in India more than in any other part of the world. Some scholars see jatis as the product of division of labor, in which families specialized in one or another occupation. Environmental historians, including Ramachandra Guha, argue that jatis were adaptations to the local environment, where each ecological niche provided an opportunity for a particular social group, parallel to how various species and subspecies of animals and plants adapt in order to thrive in specific conditions. Overall, most jatis became customarily hereditary, which means that they were endogamous. That is, marriages generally took place within jatis. But we've seen that hypergamy was generally accepted in the Veda. So women marrying into higher ranked families within the same jati, or even intermarriage into a higher ranked jati, was also occasionally occurring. Genetic evidence seems to suggest this intermarriage actually took place from time to time, even if it was not customarily approved. What's more, each jati was commensal, that is, they had a particular diet specific to their jati. Some were vegetarian, although for some jatis that included eating fish. Some jatis were non-vegetarian, but customarily only ate certain kinds of meats. On ritual occasions, the members of a jati would openly dine together, signifying their shared identity. Since almost all of a person's physical body is the product of the food he or she eats, eating the same food from the same cooking pots makes all members of a jati have much the same bodily substance. While Varnas and jatis were similar in some of their organizing principles of rank and traditional occupation, they were on very different scales. There have always only been four Varnas, but anthropologists today identify between 10,000 and 20,000 jatis, depending on how the jatis are defined. While the current median size of a jati is between 5,000 and 15,000 people, they range in size from a few hundred to millions. But the Varna and the jati systems overlap as well. In later Brahmanic theory, each jati is part of a Varna, as we'll see later when we examine the post-Vedic text known as the Shastras. So each of the four Varnas contains hundreds or even thousands of jatis. But in practice, the members of many jatis claim to be part of a higher Varna than other people in society recognize. This conflation of Varna and jati into caste, begun by the earliest Portuguese explorers who reached India, has therefore led to five centuries of ambiguity. What emerged from these social, cultural, and economic developments was a complex and diverse society. While Brahmins were all part of one Varna, they also diverged into different ways of life, which became distinct jatis. But high Varna status was not directly linked with the amount of wealth a Brahmin had. Rather, Brahmins who were less engaged in the world tended to rank higher in ritual terms. Some Brahmins were especially revered. Receiving gifts of land, cattle, and other wealth from respectful rulers and merchants, these Brahmins could devote themselves to reciting the Veda and performing its ritual sacrifices within their homes. But they did so not only for their own benefit or the benefit of their families, but also for the benefit of humanity as a whole. Ideally, these Brahmins did not themselves engage in business or farm their lands, since those were mere worldly matters. Other Brahmins withdrew from society in order to pursue higher forms of spiritual and mystical knowledge. Some of these took on ascetic practices to control their desires and liberate themselves from their physical bodies and from the material world. Such thinking highlighted the theoretical difference between the abstract concept of male and female. In this model, the male often sought to rise above desire and live as an ascetic, while a female often tried to draw him back into living as a family man, surrounded by sons. This meant that desire was the source of creation and birth into this material world. To escape this material world, therefore, one should abandon desire. Some late Vedic hymns celebrate those long-haired ascetics who relinquished society and wandered homelessly, without desire, seeking unity with the divine. The forest and esoteric books, the Aranyakas and Upanishads, emerged largely from this path as thinkers and philosophers considered the nature of the self, Atman, and its relationship to the universe as a whole, called Brahman. They are part of Vedanta, or the end or goal of the Vedas. This philosophy developed sophisticated ideas about the entire universe as a single entity. This monism contrasts with the idea that the divine was separate from humans and all other parts of the manifest world, which was the philosophy of dualism. Another philosophical concept that appeared was the idea that the universe itself went through cycles. Each cycle, or yuga, had four stages in which conditions became spiritually and sequentially worse. The first yuga, which lasted 4,800 God years, was a time when every part of the universe followed the proper path, or dharma. Each God year is 360 human years, so this first yuga lasted 1,728,000 human years. But the next yuga was worse, the third worse yet, and the final, or Kali Yuga, in which we currently live is filled with disorder, with nothing following its dharma perfectly. This yuga is only 1,200 God years long. At its end, the entire universe collapses, but then a new cycle begins again with the golden first yuga and the restoration of dharma. Many philosophers and historians of religion in India and around the world still look at the Aranyakas and Upanishads for insights into the nature of the universe and existence itself. Yet other Brahmins worked as professional priests, performing Vedic ritual sacrifices for patrons. The late Vedas show numerous specialities emerging among priests, some pouring the sacrifice into the fire, others as expert chanters of the Veda, still others as the supervising conductor of the ritual. The name Brahmin comes from the last type of priests, since he had to know the entire ritual. According to Brahmanic convention, priests had to be married in order to perform their ritual duties. So did their patrons. Thus, although women did not customarily act in the ritual, sometimes wives had to be present in the sacred arena. But professional priests necessarily were obliged to serve others in society, including many non-Brahmins. In some rituals, by removing death from their patron, the priests were symbolically taking it upon themselves. This led to a lower ritual status for such priests who worked for kings and other wealthy people. Indeed, a stock character in many Sanskrit dramas would be the king's attendant, a wise fool, who was a Brahmin. Of course, many Brahmins did engage in trade, farming, or other forms of commerce. But no matter how wealthy such worldly Brahmins became, they customarily ranked lower than those other, less worldly Brahmins. Rivalries about primacy seem to have occurred among these Brahmanic paths. Particular Jatis of Brahmins tended to follow one or another of these ways of life, with their children conventionally following the lifestyle of their parents, but with some individuals moving among them over the course of their lives. Likewise, among Kshatriyas, many different Jatis developed. These Jatis were often called Rajputs, literally sons of kings or princes. Such warrior clans led their followers, or Jana, to occupy and control territories, sometimes settling uncivilized, uncultivated regions, sometimes displacing or subordinating other groups already living there. In the early Vedic period, some men rose up to become war leaders, but did not actually rule during peacetime. In the late Vedic period, hereditary rajas or kings gradually emerged as rulers of distinct kingdoms, or janapada, literally people's places. To confirm or renew their royal power, rajas often employed Brahmin professional priests to perform elaborate rituals for them. This meant that the king was the patron, even though the Brahmins ranked above him ritually. These rivalries would remain a theme throughout Indian history. Late Vedic hymns describe such a royal consecration rite, or Rajasuya. Among the grandest of such rites was the Ashvamedha, in which Brahmin priests sanctified a special horse to represent the king. Then the horse was let loose to roam symbolically throughout the universe. In mundane terms, the horse was physically directed to move only through that Raja's own kingdom, or, more ambitiously, to enter a neighboring kingdom. Should that neighboring Raja oppose the passage of the sacred horse, their armies would clash. If defeated, the neighboring Raja would have to accept subordinate status to the conquering king. At the end of the year, the horse returned to his king's capital so that its sacred power could be ritually transferred to him. So powerful was this ritual that some places in North India are still named after it. For example, a river landing in the center of the ancient city that's today known as Benares is named Dashashvamedh Ghat, the place where 10 horse sacrifices were successfully performed. As we'll see in a later lecture, Brahmin sacrificial priests would eventually reject blood sacrifices and substitute vegetable matter for the horse and other sacrificed animals. When we look at the textual and linguistic evidence from the late Vedic period, the centuries before and after 500 BCE, we can count between 600 and 700 different Janapadas scattered across north and central India, centering on the Gangetic Plain, but extending beyond that as well. At first, each Jana functioned like a community, regardless of where it was located. The chief or Raja headed the community. But gradually, each Jana settled down in a particular geographical and ecological niche. Over time, a network of towns and one or more cities developed. Communities began to develop a relationship to that particular place. Each place contained a particular mix of Varnas and Jatis. Each developed its own cultural identity with a language or dialect, distinguishing its inhabitants from those of neighboring Janapadas. Political and commercial links within each Janapada were also strong. Some Janapadas evidently had a more powerful ruling Raja who had territorially bounded authority. Others seem to have had a Raja as a temporary war leader, while, especially when not at war, some degree of political and social authority seems to have been exerted by a council of men representing the leading clans or Jatis within that kingdom, with the Raja just as the chairman. The development of the economy also strengthened mercantile groups. Trade often extended beyond the kingdom's boundaries, with exports of locally sourced raw materials and also goods produced by local artisans, and imports of needed resources. We begin to see money in the form of actual silver or copper coins appearing from about the 6th century BCE. Such an even partially monetized economy enabled commerce to flourish as never before. To manage particular kinds of production and commerce, merchants developed trini, or trade guilds. These seem to have been coordinating the prices charged and paid by its members, leading to their cooperation rather than competition. These trini were another likely source for the jatis of merchants and artisans among the Vaishya and Shudra Varnas. To carry the grain, hand-manufactured products, and other goods, jatis of transporters and mobile traders emerged. Often such transporters loaded their cargo on the backs of bullocks or other cattle, which meant that they were not dependent on smooth roads as would be carts or wagons. Given the torrential monsoon rains that bring floods every year, maintaining roads has always been a major issue in India. And with many regional states and only rare empires, many rulers did not see long-distance road building and repair as part of their obligation. Further, many people were not systematically integrated into the economy. There were still many Adivasi living in the forests who rarely paid taxes and periodically emerged to raid, as well as to trade with the settled farmers nearby. Sometimes these Adivasi groups became associated or integrated with the surrounding society of settled agriculturalists. These Adivasi groups then functioned as a low-ranked jati. As various Janapadas developed into kingdoms, especially in North India, they produced accounts of fabled warriors and kings. Starting around the 5th century BCE, these accounts were gradually collected into extended epics by bards, who were often Brahmin courtiers. Royal patrons supported such bards and relished their poetic accounts in Sanskrit of heroic accomplishments of their cultural and sometimes biological ancestors. In the next lectures, we will explore the two major Indian epics, the Ramayana and then the Mahabharata, which convey the values and the material culture of that ancient age.